If you're pulled over, suspected of drunk driving, and refuse a breath test, there are consequences. But what about alcohol and boating? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A case of drunken boating is currently before the Iowa Supreme Court. In the first half hour, University of Iowa law professor Todd Pettis walks us through some of the more significant current Supreme Court cases here in Iowa and also before the nation's high court. Then a conversation with Kevin Cooney. Cooney is about to retire as news anchor for the Central Iowa TV station KCCI after more than 30 years. I'll ask him about some of his more notable interviews, including one with President George H.W. Bush aboard Air Force One. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The current session of the Iowa Supreme Court is well underway. In this half hour, we want to get a sense of some of the most significant current cases before Iowa's High Court. Also talk about a few cases before the U.S. Supreme Court of significance. And joining us to walk us through a handful of these cases in our Iowa City studio, Todd Pettis, a professor of law at the University of Iowa. Todd, welcome back to our studio.
Thanks very much, Ben.
Well, let's get underway. We have a number of cases to talk about. Always fascinating to hear the stories behind the cases and the arguments and then also the question or questions before the court. Let's take a look at a case. Describe the case here. We know about drunken driving and, of course, serious consequences for doing that. Boating. We have boating accidents in the state, some of them related to alcohol influence as well, but this is a case that deals with drunken boating.
It does, indeed, and the Iowa General Assembly has taken steps in recent years to kind of equalize the, I would say, the law of drunken boating and drunken driving. They both involve motors. They both involve speed. They both involve physical safety. You can imagine collisions and so forth. And so just as 0.08, for example, is the blood alcohol limit for drunk driving when you're talking about cars, it's the same limit when it comes to boating.
A few years ago, that didn't used to be.
That's right.
The case you could drink on a boat, be actually legally intoxicated in a car, but on a boat, you were not legally intoxicated.
Yeah. Well, now it's much the same. And so this first case we're talking about today, State versus Pettijohn, involves a man, Dale Pettijohn Jr., who was out on a lake, Sailorville Lake in Des Moines. And he is pulled over by a water patrol officer. The officer observes bloodshot eyes and signs of intoxication. Mr. Pettijohn is ultimately taken back to the station and given a breath test, and his blood alcohol is measured being well over the legal limit. There's two legal issues in this case. One of them has to do with the stop of the boat, and one of them has to do with the breath test back at the station. So just in a nutshell, we'll talk first here about this, the stop of the boat. Whether you're walking down the street or driving in your car or out on a boat, in general, if the police are going to stop you, they need to have a reason. They need to have a warrant, or there needs to be an exception to a warrant, because it's called a seizure. And we know that under the Iowa Constitution and under the federal Constitution, there's a law against unreasonable searches and seizures. Well, when the police stop your movement and say, you're not going anywhere, we're going to talk to you for a while, that's a seizure, and it has to be justified. And in this case, the boat was stopped, and it was through that stop that the officer got close enough to observe that Mr. Pettijohn appeared to be intoxicated. He was not operating the boat in terms of driving in a reckless way. He was driving very slowly. His eyes evidently were forward. He wasn't swerving back and forth or anything. But the reason the officer pulled him over was that there was a woman on the boat who was dangling her feet over the back of the boat, evidently pretty close to the propeller. Mm. This is a rental boat. Evidently, the officer knows that these rental boats don't have a propeller guard on them, so he pulls the boat over because of that. A couple different legal reasons why he might do it. One is there's a statute that bars operating a boat in a reckless way that might harm someone. And one of the issues that the court could choose to resolve in this case is, when the statute talks about operating a boat in a reckless way, even apart from alcohol now, okay, just operating a boat in a reckless way, does that have to do with just the manner of driving the boat, or can it also concern the conduct of other people who are on the boat?
I see.
So if you have someone sitting on the back of the boat with their feet near the propeller and you're continuing to drive, are you committing a crime? That's one issue that the court may address in this case. And if the court says that, yes, indeed, you can be convicted of a crime, that's clearly going to be of great interest to anyone who drives a boat in Iowa. There's another issue in that case having to do with an exception called the community caretaker exception. And that's probably not worth going into a lot of detail about, but it's kind of an emerging exception to the warrant requirement. It traces its roots back a few decades. And it says that if a police officer, they're not investigating crime, but they see someone who's in some danger, who's in some need, the public mm-hmm. is at some risk, that the police can intervene. And one of the claims the state is making here is that when they stopped the boat, it was because this woman was in some danger. With respect to that, Mr. Pettijohn says you didn't have to stop the boat, actually come up and literally stop the boat, just holler out, hey, get your feet up. And if that had been what the officer had done, then he never would have gotten close enough.
Yeah, it's all right for an officer to point out a safety issue, but what he found out by getting close to the boat, the bloodshot eyes, and then the later discovery of alcohol.
Right. Yeah, if the officer had shouted something out, there'd be no issue in the case, but the officer chose instead to stop the boat. And so that's the first cluster of legal issues in this case, was the stop of the boat okay? The other set of issues in the case has to do with what happened once they got back to the station. Now, let's go back to the situation with cars mm-hmm. driving automobiles. There's a law in Iowa, as there is, I think, in just about every state. It's called an implied consent law, which says that when you get your driver's license to drive a car and you then put it to work by going out and driving on the streets, you are implicitly agreeing that if a law enforcement officer has reason to think that you are drunk and driving, they can give you a blood alcohol test in one form or another.
Usually a breath test.
Yeah, yeah. And you've agreed to that merely by accepting the driver's license and going out and driving. And if you refuse the test, you can lose your driver's license for a period of time. Okay? It's called implied consent. Well, Iowa statutes impose the same arrangement when it comes to boating. If you're out boating and appear to be intoxicated, you have, under the law, implicitly consented to have your blood alcohol tested. And in this case, when they got back to the station, the officer said, now, we want you to take this test. If you don't take this test, you're going to be fined. You can be fined a substantial amount, and you'll also lose your privilege of boating. You won't be allowed to operate a boat for, I don't know what time period they gave him, but I think it was at least a year.
And Mr. Pettijohn refused?
Mr. Pettijohn consented, but he says that his consent was coerced. He said, you basically forced me to do this. I didn't willingly agree to have my blood tested. You threatened me in a way that's illegitimate. And he says, when it comes to boating, that's different than cars. We all have a natural right to go out on a boat. We don't have to get a license to operate a boat. The waterways are these natural phenomena. The state can't regulate those waterways in the same way that it can regulate driving. And so we may find out from the Iowa Supreme Court some things about.
Do we know what precedents in other states, will that be a guide for the justices here?
It could be. I don't think there's a lot, though, that the court's likely to find. They may find a few instances here and there, but I don't think there's a rich body of case law out there that just dictates what the court's going to do here.
Okay. Decision, I see, before the end of the calendar year, we're expecting that to come down.
I think so. These first few cases we're talking about today, this one included, it was argued before the court in mid-September, and, it varies, but, 2-3 months, something like that. There's no rule that says when the court has to hand it down, but that's a good guess, I think.
You've just joined us. Todd Pettis, law professor at the University of Iowa, walking us through some of the more significant cases before the Iowa Supreme Court that involved drunken boating. Let's talk about one that comes out of Iowa City, has reached the high court in the state, and deals with renters' rights, how far landlords can go in charging tenants for certain things. What is the case here about?
Well, Elise DeStefano and I think some roommates lived in a house here in Iowa City, and they rented it from Apartments Downtown, a big landlord here in town. There's a provision of the lease that my guess is Ms. DeStefano hadn't paid much attention to before. Maybe she did. But what prompted this attention to the lease was that a day or evening came along and a burglar kicked down their front door. Okay, no one knows who the burglar was. There never was an arrest for it, so we can't pin the financial damages on that burglar. So somebody came along, kicked down the door, goes inside, and they evidently stole a few things and left. Now, that door's got to be fixed, right? Well, there's a provision in the lease that says that the tenant agrees to pay for all damages to the apartment windows, screens, and doors, including random acts of vandalism. So the landlord came out, had the repairs done, and then gave the tenant a bill for about $600. Mm-hmm. And the tenant said, I didn't cause the damage. I don't know who it was, but some outside party came and committed a crime, kicked down the door. I should not have to pay for that. And so the legal issue in front of the court is, can the cost of this damage and other damage, other kind of repair costs, be shifted somewhere in the terms of this lease, be shifted to the tenant? And it's interesting because in the oral arguments, and both in the Pettijohn case we just talked about, and this one too, if you take an interest in the case, you can go online and watch the videos of the attorneys arguing these cases. It was Justice Wiggins, I think, who asked the attorney for Apartments Downtown a question and said, well, under the logic of your argument, are you saying that a landlord could put a provision in the lease saying that the tenant has to completely rebuild the structure if an arsonist comes along and just torches the place and burns it absolutely to the ground?
An absurd idea.
Well,
or not.
Well,
I mean, it seems absurd.
Buildings do get burned to the ground, and
no, yeah,
someone
of
has
course,
to pay for it.
But that the tenants would have to pay for an arsonist to work.
Well, that was clearly the tenor of Justice Wiggins' question, was surely you're not saying that the tenant can be made to pay for this. But the attorney's response was, well, it's a hypothetical question, but the cost can be shifted to the tenant. Now, this is one of the things that courts do at oral argument, is they take the logic of a party's argument and they try to figure out, okay, now if we agree with you today, what are we signing on for? What does this mean for other cases of other facts? And that's kind of a nice little hypothetical that I think tested the nature of the argument, and it really kind of reveals, I think, what the argument is. And so this is a big case for landlord-tenant law in the state of Iowa. If the landlord wins, it means that I think that tenants are going to have to look carefully at the terms of the lease and try to obtain insurance to cover themselves, if they can obtain it, to cover themselves against costs such as this. If the tenant wins this case, then there are a lot of leases in the state already, I think, that are going to be invalid with respect to certain terms. And so there are a lot of people who follow landlord-tenant law, both in Iowa and I think also outside of Iowa, who are going to watch this case to see how the court comes down.
I wonder if a ruling would go in the tenant's favor here, if someone who, say, rented from Apartments Downtown or another renter with a contract with a stipulation like this, could they go back 3 years and say, hey, I was charged for this, and under the new court ruling, I shouldn't have been. Could I get my money back?
Yeah, there certainly is going to be if they can do that at all, there's going to be a time limit on how far they back then go. That's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, if it was relatively recently, the odds are better. Though even then, I'm not sure that they can do that. We're going to talk actually in one of the cases we get to a little bit in just a little bit about a legal doctrine called retroactivity. When the court says something new about the law, when does it apply backward in time? And those raise pretty complex legal questions often.
Todd Pettis with us. Law professor at the University of Iowa, going through some Iowa State Supreme Court cases of note currently before the high court in the state. The State versus Sweet is a case that has to do with something that's been in our news quite a bit. Sentencing a minor to life without parole, can a state do that?
Yeah, and this both nationally and in Iowa, I would say, is one of the hottest areas in criminal law in the last several years. There have been significant changes both at the federal level and at the state level. This particular case involves a young man named Isaiah Sweet, who in Manchester, Iowa, in May 2012, shot and killed his grandparents with whom he lived. It's a terrible story. The grandparents' bodies were discovered on Mother's Day, when one of the grandparents' daughters and granddaughter came for a Mother's Day dinner, and dog was barking on the inside and no one was answering the door and so forth. When Isaiah Sweet committed that crime, he was just over 17 years old. So he was a juvenile. He's younger than 18 years. He was sentenced to life without parole. He's got two arguments in front of the Iowa Supreme Court, and the second is the potentially more dramatic. And that argument is he argues that the Iowa Constitution categorically bans life without parole sentences for all juvenile offenders, no matter what the circumstances.
For any particular reason, as cruel and unusual, or?
That's the legal hook for the claim exactly, is that the Iowa Constitution, like the federal Constitution, bans cruel and unusual punishment. And he says when we're talking about juveniles, people who commit their crimes when they're legally children, it is cruel and unusual punishment to say we're incarcerating you for the rest of your life. There's no hope whatsoever that you'll be able to get out of prison. In making that argument, he's building on a line of cases both at the federal level and at the state level that has been inching in that direction, but that has not yet crossed that line, if it will ever cross that line. And so the United States Supreme Court has said, for example, that juvenile murderers cannot be executed. If someone commits murder while under the age of 18, it is violation of federal law to execute them. The United States Supreme Court has also said that if a juvenile commits a crime other than murder, you can't give them life without parole. Mm-hmm. That leaves a question about, okay, well, when a juvenile does commit murder, can we give them a life without parole and under what circumstances? And Mr. Sweet is asking the Iowa Supreme Court to kind of nationally get out in front on this issue and be one of the first state Supreme – in fact, I think they'd be the second state Supreme Court in the country if they go this way to hold that the Iowa Constitution does say this. Mm-hmm. Now, the justices are not writing on a clean slate here. There's a case just last year called State versus Seats where one of the justices said that in his view the Iowa Constitution does categorically ban life without parole sentences for all juvenile offenders. Three of the justices said, no, that's not the case. And so what we're really waiting to see is what are the other three justices going to say? It undoubtedly is going to be a divided opinion.
Okay, we'll wait for that decision later in the year from the Iowa Supreme Court. Todd Pettis, this I'm looking at notes on a U.S. Supreme Court case currently before the nation's high court, Montgomery v. Louisiana. Another juvenile sentencing case, but this one with a different sort of twist.
Yeah, and it's quite a twist because the man who's bringing this case is now 69 years old. And how we come about that twist is that this concerns a murder that was committed in Louisiana way back in 1963. Okay, this young man is he was then a young man, Henry Montgomery. He's living in East Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's skipping school. I think he's a junior in high school. He's skipping school. A sheriff's deputy approaches him, and he shoots and kills the sheriff's deputy, evidently fearing that he's about to get afraid for missing school or something. The officer is white. Mr. Montgomery is black. This is Louisiana in 1963. So there's clearly a racial dimension to the story. He's initially sentenced to death. That conviction is vacated because of some KKK activity that had kind of emerged during the trial that was thought to have tainted things. So ultimately, he was sentenced to life without parole. And so he's been, you know, in prison now for more than half a century. So he's 69 years old, and he's looking at this line of cases that we just described a moment ago, the case where they said the United States Supreme Court said, well, you can't execute juveniles. You can't sentence juveniles to life without parole if they didn't commit murder. And then in another case, the really important one here called Miller versus Alabama, this is decided in 2012. And in the Miller case, the United States Supreme Court said that if you're going to sentence a juvenile murderer to life without parole, you have to hold a sentencing hearing first. This is something that we don't always do for adults, but you need to do it for juveniles. And in that sentencing hearing, we're going to have a conversation about this particular kid. How mature were they? What were the circumstances of the crime? Is there evidence of peer pressure? Do we think that this person can be rehabilitated? Did they have a very tough upbringing? All these kinds of things that we don't necessarily ask before sentencing an adult to a mandatory sentence. Well, what Mr. Montgomery says is that ruling in 2012, Miller versus Alabama, ought to retroactively apply to him so that he now at 69 or maybe 70 by the time the decision comes down, he deserves a sentencing hearing as a juvenile in a sense to go back and say, speaking to me as a juvenile, should I ever have been sentenced to life without parole? If he wins, it creates a very unusual sentencing hearing, I think. You know, he's 69 or 70, and he surely was the youngest player in this whole scene. Many of the other people, you know, witnesses, relatives, potential witnesses, have long since died. But that's what we would be looking at. Now, there are some people in this litigation who are urging the United States Supreme Court to say that the federal constitution bans all life without parole sentences for juveniles, just as the Iowa Supreme Court is being asked to rule in Isaiah Sweet's case. I don't think it's likely the U.S. Supreme Court will say that in this particular case, but it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Todd Pettis, we have about 3 minutes left, a little less than 3 minutes. So many court cases. Interesting. We'll certainly be talking about these cases with you and with your colleagues as well as they are decided and when they're all decided. But in the couple minutes that we have left, do we have another case you'd like to give us a brief survey on?
Well, I'll just mention a couple. I'll mention case names so people can Google them or look them up if they sound interesting. So here's just very quickly two or three cases. Fisher versus University of Texas. The Fisher case has to do with affirmative action in higher education. Mm-hmm. And a particular part of the University of Texas admissions program that gives preferences in some instances to members of minority racial groups. So we have an affirmative action case. There's a union case called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association that has to do with whether unions, which gather together government employees, whether people who choose to work in that workplace but don't want to join the union can nevertheless be forced to pay for some collective bargaining expenses. If the challengers win there, that's going to be a huge blow to unions. And then there's a case out of Texas called, it's either Evenwell or Evenwell, it's E-V-E-N-W-E-L-L. And that case has to do with which people do we count when deciding how much representation a community is going to get in a legislative body? Are we counting all breathing human beings, or are we counting only people who are eligible to vote? And that case, in order to explain it, we'd have to get into some math and different models and so forth. But if you're interested in representative democracy and notions of who do our people represent, that's an interesting case to look up.
Plenty to talk about in the future. Fascinating cases before both the U.S. and the Iowa Supreme Court. Quickly, before we have to say goodbye in this last minute here, we always talk about Retirement Watch. If my quick math is right, about 16 months left of this second Obama term, would it be thinkable that a Supreme Court justice would retire at this point?
Not thinkable, I don't think, absent a health crisis of some kind during the term, which carries us forward into next spring, early summer. We could see one then. That would come right in the heat of a presidential campaign. Hard to imagine a justice would do that, but health sometimes dictates these things, and so it's possible.
You've named a number of these cases. Last session, of course, momentous with the Affordable Care Act, also the same-sex marriage decision. This a little bit less momentous, even though very significant.
Yeah, so far, I think. There's not one case that stands out at this point that's really going to mark the term in the same way that, say, a same-sex marriage ruling or something marked a prior term.
Todd Pettis, thanks for dropping by. Giving some insight on these cases. Law professor at the University of Iowa, Todd Pettis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with Kevin Cooney. Cooney is about to retire as news anchor for the Central Iowa TV station KCCI after more than 3 decades. A conversation with him in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
We bring Iowa
It's 10 o'clock. And now, Kevin Cooney, Dave Buzik, Pete Taylor.
A theme and an introduction that's very familiar to many Iowans in the central part of the state. After more than 30 years, Kevin Cooney is about to retire as news anchor for the Central Iowa TV station KCCI. And this half hour, he joins us to reflect on his decades of work in TV journalism for Central Iowa. Kevin Cooney in our Des Moines studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate it.
You've covered several presidential elections, I want to start off by having you recall some of the encounters you've had with some of our presidents. I understand at one point you interviewed George H.W. Bush, President Bush 41, I guess we say, too, on board Air Force One. How did that come about?
It was shortly before about 4 years into his term, mm-hmm. and just before his second election. And it was one of those deals where if you wanted to interview the president, you had to be here or do this. And, you know, the Republican Party was kind of calling the shots, so to speak. So I had to fly to Detroit, where the president was meeting or was having a rally, so to speak, I think at the old Cobo Hall, Cobo Arena, and hook up with the entourage, so to speak, there, and do the interview while he was flying to South Dakota. And so it's exactly what I did. You know, right. Usually one does not get an interview on board Air Force One.
Uh-huh. What struck you about being on Air Force One and seeing the president and interviewing him there?
Well, you know what was really interesting? I mean, the president was obviously as proud of the plane as he was just about anything else, and gave us a tour of Air Force One. And that included, he just seemed to be very, very impressed with the fact that he could take a shower while he was flying over the country. And he was quite proud of the fact that he had a shower on board Air Force One. And so we wanted to make sure that we saw that and also saw this kind of conversation pit, if you will, that was in the nose of the plane. It was quite a privilege to get the first class tour, so to speak, from the president.
Mm-hmm. You've talked to other presidents. Who else stands out during your career?
I probably talked to President Obama the most, but I think that that's probably because his is certainly the most media savvy administration out there. They proved it when they were originally campaigning with, you know, social media, mm-hmm. And whatnot, and have just carried that through in terms of how they deal with the media.
Now, Kevin, now our listeners who are not in the business, you and I are journalists, mm-hmm. explain what you mean when you say a candidate is media savvy.
Well, I think a candidate candidates have lots of handlers. Candidates have lots of people telling them what to do. And as technology has changed, I think the most successful candidates have been those that have adapted to, you know, the changing media, the way to get the message out, going all the way back to, you know, 1960. I mean, who was the most telegenic of the two candidates for president, you know, Richard Nixon or John F. Kennedy? And I think it showed that things were changing in terms of how presidential campaigns or how any campaign was run. Mm-hmm. You go back to, I think, the first television ad for a presidential campaign was for President Eisenhower, and it's just hilarious. You could look it up on YouTube if you wanted to. It's just a hilarious.
Well, we've been doing some recent things about that, going back and listening and watching, and it's all on YouTube, of course. Jimmy Carter's early TV ads are amazing to watch as a historical piece of media. But I wonder, you know, when you started. I'm guessing we had you know three networks plus mm-hmm. plus PBS, now hundreds and hundreds of cable channels. Also, not to mention all the ways you can get your news online. Any observations about how, as our technology has morphed and blossomed, I guess I should say, how that's changed the political coverage for you?
Well, I think there's more coverage out there. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You're right. You know, when I first got into the business, there was, as you said, you know, three television networks, commercial networks, and public television. And so what's happened now is it started, you know, in 1980 with this thing called CNN and 24-hour news. And then after that, we saw satellites. It worked in two different directions, I think, Ben, and in that we had satellite television technology in terms of how we received it and how we transmitted it as consumers and as providers, if you will. All of a sudden, we could do live television from anywhere in the world. We could do 24 hours of television in terms of news broadcasting. As the satellites, you know, became more and more accessible, if you will, to local stations above and beyond networks. You saw local stations doing more coverage. And then you also saw the expansion on the cable spectrum when you had Fox come in, you had MSNBC, you had some cable channel, news channels that have gone by the wayside now, too. But technology has kind of driven it now into the internet age, and you have so many outlets, so to speak, on the internet, video everywhere.
Yeah, does it strike you too that, I mean, back when we had the three networks plus public television, that we were consuming a lot of the same, we were hearing different views. Now, especially in the area of politics, don't you think you can find the church you like and just stay there and have your views reinforced and challenged less?
Oh, I think that's very true. I'm not sure whether one is better than the other, really, because you're still only, you know, you're still kind of focusing on one area. I think one person certainly has access to so many different viewpoints, and I think the person who does that is going to be better informed, obviously. The thing that's happened is you have that access now. You have the ability to hear different viewpoints, to read different blogs, to see a variety of different outlets from a variety of different sources, be they politically oriented or religiously oriented or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. Just so much access that we have now that I think we're definitely in a better shape. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, if that's all you read or that's all you listen to or that's all you see, I think it can have the opposite effect. We can become quite myopic in our viewpoint.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, Kevin Cooney is joining me this half hour, news anchor for KCCI-TV in Des Moines. He's coming up on retirement. You announced it in May on your broadcast there. I'd like to play a few seconds, if you don't mind, Kevin, you announcing it. You said, I think you prefaced this by saying, I didn't want to do this with a press release. I just want to tell you folks here, we have this you have this relationship with your viewers, and here's a little bit of what it sounded like back in May, Kevin Cooney announcing retirement.
Well, speaking of retirement, a little programming note, as we say in this business, about retirement. I've been privileged to be in your living rooms going on 33 years on the news at 6 and 10. And because of that, I consider us all friends, which is why I want you to hear this from me and not in some press release. I'm going to be leaving this anchor desk and retiring in November. This chair will be filled by a journalist who has anchored KCCI newscasts for more than 20 years. We're talking about our friend Steve Carlin. As you know, Steve is an excellent reporter, an excellent anchor.
Okay, that was your announcement there, Kevin. Obviously a little bit choked up there.
Yeah.
What will you miss most?
It's kind of like high school. In a way, you know, I look back upon high school or college, and what you miss most is just the daily contact with friends, with people.
Right.
It's not that you don't maintain that contact after you leave high school or college or a job, but you don't have that daily, contact, the casual walking in, what's up, what's new with so-and-so, what's going on with the kids, you know, hey, you know, the dog got sick and things like this. That, I think, is what I'm going to miss the most. And I think that's what a lot of people miss most, no matter what their profession is. From a professional standpoint, I will miss the daily grind, so to speak. There are not too many jobs where you go in, and while the fundamentals of what you do are basically the same, we do the 5, 6, and 10 o'clock news on my shift. And if you just look at it from that standpoint, it might be kind of boring. But the thing is, the content is different every day.
Right. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah.
With you and your crew over the years, are you always of one mind or pretty much all the time? Or are there disagreements?
No. I've been texting back and forth with people at the station today, disagreement or that I won't get into any, you know, detail about, because it doesn't make any difference to anybody except for those of us in the newsroom. But, you know, a disagreement over what was or was not covered is common, what is or is not covered on the shows. We have news staff meetings and story meetings 2 and 3 times a day. People throw stories out. They'll fight for their stories. They'll say, I think we should be doing this. And you can kind of tell how dedicated someone is. If their story gets shot down one day, they'll come back the next day and they'll say, hey, you know, this is still a pretty good story. And sometimes, you know, they'll win out over the time.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a definition of news that you like?
Well, never really thought about any solid definition. There are a variety of
you know it when you see it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like some other things. But the I think it's what people are talking about. News is what's different out there. It's what's changed. People complain sometimes about the about bad news. Why is there so much bad news on the news? And right. You know, Eric Severide gave a rather interesting explanation that I'll try and summarize, which is, you know, we live in a good society. For the most part, things are pretty good. Most people don't break the law. People are living their lives out just like normal, everyday folks. So when something abnormal happens to that lifestyle, when it's a crime or a major political change or a war or something like that, that's abnormal. That's what's different. If all the news was good, then by that definition, it would mean that we're living in a bad society, and what's really different is when somebody does something good. And I know that's kind of convoluted, but I always appreciated that kind of explanation. It's like, you know, sometimes bad news, if you're getting bad news, it means that, you know, life is, for the most part, pretty good. And when something really different happens that's bad, that's actually, you know, a reflection of our society that is a lot better than if it was – everything was good news.
Right. We have this dark journalistic phrase that is used, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have conversations or wrestled with that a bit over the years so that you do want to say, hey, wait a minute, we don't want to, you know, just concentrate on the dark side, even though that's of interest to people, is to make sure that in every broadcast you have something positive there about your community?
I think they're I'm not sure we set a quota to have something like that in every newscast, but I think there generally is. We tell the stories of people who are doing good things for their community. Just yesterday, Eric Hansen does a wonderful job. As a matter of fact, Eric was in New York yesterday accepting a National Murrow Award for his reporting. And Eric, who most folks may know in central Iowa, is our morning news anchor, but he is also one of the best reporters in the country when it comes to feature reporting. And the story that he had yesterday was how a couple of frozen yogurt shops in Pella and I think Oskaloosa were they're operated by volunteers, and the money that they raise and that comes from selling all this frozen yogurt goes to underdeveloped countries to just help out, and some of it goes locally too to help build a Habitat for Humanity house, things like this. Some of the money goes over to Africa to help underprivileged families over there. So those are the type of stories that show, I think, what people are doing. You know, show the good news, you know, kind of what we're talking about, Ben. But, news is like, you say, if it bleeds, it leads. News is like anything else. It's like clothing. It's like style. It's like fashion or something like that. What is news is kind of falls into a pretty narrow spectrum. But how it's presented and that type of stuff, I think, changes. If you were to put on the old newscasts from Walter Cronkite and John Chancellor and Huntley and Brinkley and stuff like that, people would fall asleep. Those were pretty boring newscasts. It was great reporting that was going on, but from a visual standpoint, according to today's standards, they were pretty boring.
Retiring a news anchor for KCCI-TV in Des Moines, Kevin Cooney is with us live this half hour. I want to ask you about another memorable interview that you did with Iowa State alum Terry Anderson. Mm-hmm. He was taken hostage. This was part of one of the hostages taken by the Iranians in the late 1970s.
Lebanon.
Sorry, I'm getting my hostage situation mixed up here.
Unfortunately, there have been so many.
Yeah, 1993, you interviewed him. And this was sort of a technological feed, I understand, via satellite.
Well, yes. It was kind of like what we were talking about earlier, Ben, you know, the technology. This was in about 1991, I think. Terry had been held hostage for the better part of 6 years, along with Thomas Sutherland, another name that many Iowans will be very, very familiar with. Tom was released just about 10 days before Terry was. They had held a whole series of hostages over there, moved them around. And Terry was the one of the first ones held hostage and one of the last ones, he was the last one released. When the hostages, all of the hostages were released, they were all taken to Wiesbaden, at that time, I believe, West Germany, and where the U.S. had a medical hospital, military medical hospital, and they were checked out and made sure they were okay and kind of debriefed and everything like that. And so when Terry was released, he had a news conference, and so we had just gotten finished covering Tom Sutherland and had flown back to Des Moines and, you know, gotten ourselves all settled back in. And sure enough, the word came out that Terry was going to be released here the next couple of days or so, where the rumor was. So, boom, we hopped on an airplane again, flew back over there. And I'm sorry, long answer to the short question is that the we did have access to CBS satellites over in Wiesbaden. So we were able to feed out stories of Terry's release, of Tom's release, of a brief, you know, conversation that we would have with those gentlemen, usually in the form of a news conference. But the technology allowed us to do that, something that, you know, 10 years earlier we wouldn't have been able to do.
And I understand you were acquainted with Terry Anderson.
Terry and I were classmates at Iowa State University. Terry's a few years older than I am. He was in the Marines, and then upon leaving the Marines, went to Iowa State and then worked at then KRNT-TV, Channel 8's KCCI's predecessor, and worked on radio at KRNT Radio at the time. And so, we were acquainted. We went to school together. We were in the broadcast department there with Jack Shelley and all the rest of the great folks up at Iowa State in the early 1970s. And so working with him at Channel 8 and going to school with him kind of kept us focused on this story. Certainly wasn't anything we were doing a story on every day for that 6 years, but we kept alive the stories of Tom and Terry's captivity. And whenever anything would come out or anything like that, we always wanted to follow it. So when these were released, it wasn't too hard of a decision to say, you know, we've covered this for 6 years or 5 years, whatever. We're going to go over and for the kind of culmination, if you will, of this
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Cooney, how long have you been in the anchor desk at KCCI?
since 1982, so that's like 33 years.
33 years. Before that, a reporter?
Before that, a reporter. I spent a couple of years in San Jose, California. And prior to that, did a little weekend anchor and feature reporting at KCCI or KRNT mm-hmm. back in those days.
You really have a journalistic family as well. Father, mother, wife?
Right. My mother was the first copy editor, female copy editor, rather, at the Des Moines Register during World War II, Des Moines Register and Tribune. My father was a city editor at the Des Moines Tribune before the Tribune went under, an afternoon newspaper victim, and was later executive editor of the Des Moines Register and Tribune Syndicate. But interestingly enough, my dad, some things go full circle in families, and this is what one of the things that I've always found so interesting is my dad. Longtime viewers and listeners and residents of Iowa will remember Russ Van Dyke. Russ Van Dyke put KRNT-TV, so to speak, on the air, and prior to that was a radio reporter for KRNT Radio. Well, back then, radio reporters really had to spend most of their time in the studio. They were doing so many radio newscasts, they used the phone and the wire services to get their sources or to get most of their news. And they hired a leg man, a first, you know, kind of reporter that went out on the scene. And that was my dad, Jim Cooney, back in the 1940s. And dad drifted into print media, but it's just I've always enjoyed the fact that, you know, one of his earliest jobs in journalism was as a broadcaster, and it got me kind of interested in it, too, in a way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We have just a minute or so left. I'm sorry. We have such short time. It's been a fascinating conversation to hear you reflect on your many years in TV journalism. I wanted to maybe finish up with this one because we talked about how journalism, the nature of journalism, has changed so much over the decades. If you were a younger person today, let's put your age at 20-something, Kevin Cooney.
Oh, please.
Would you get into journalism?
I would at the drop of a hat. People say, oh, television, you know, nobody's watching TV or television journalism. It's all changed and everything like that. Ben, this is the most exciting time to be in what you would maybe used to call broadcast journalism, multimedia journalism. For several years, I advised interns at Channel 8 News, and I have told them that I'm so jealous of them because they're getting in on the ground floor of one of the most earth-shattering, you know, events in technology and the media. The internet has changed everything, and it's kind of like being in on the ground floor of radio back in the, or TV back in the 1950s. They're rewriting everything in terms of how things are covered, the instantaneous nature of journalism now. I would advise anybody and everybody to get into it, but keep in mind, I don't think it's ever going to pay very much.
All right. Kevin Cooney, it's been a joy talking with you. I understand your last day, late November?
November 24th.
Okay, so you think...
Mark your calendars.
You'll have a problem not getting choked up on the air for that one?
I hope not. Maybe I'll pre-record it.
All right. Thank you. Kevin Cooney, news anchor for KCCI-TV in Des Moines. 30-plus years. Thanks for coming into our studio, Kevin.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Tomorrow on this program, of course, it's Politics Day, Wednesday. Republicans begging Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan to run for Speaker of the House. We'll talk with our political scientists tomorrow, Rachel Caulfield and Dennis Goldford of Drake University, about the House Republican search for a speaker and what that disarray, current disarray, says about the party of Lincoln today. Also, of course, analysis of the first Democratic presidential debate that happens this evening. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.